Welcome to another episode of The Whistle Stop. I'm Drew Ammon. Our guest is Louisville native, current Bellarmine head men's basketball coach Scotty Davenport. This season was the first in a four-year transition period for Bellarmine from Division II to Division I, and Davenport led the Knights to their first ever D1 postseason tournament, reaching the College Basketball Invitational. Under Davenport, Bellarmine went 14-8 overall, finishing second in the Atlantic Sun Conference. Davenport is the all-time wins leader at Bellarmine, and some of his other accomplishments include six regular season Great Lakes Valley Conference titles and the D2 National Championship in 2011. Former UK guard Josh Carrier joining us along with Stephen Jordan and Greg Peterson. The Whistle Stop is sponsored by Jason Stonebreaker at Campbell Chevrolet on Scottsville Road in Bowling Green, Kentucky. Visit Jason to check out new and used vehicles, new Chevrolet Tahoes, Suburbans, Traverses, and the like. Call or text Jason at 270-996-8365 to schedule your spring or summer test drive. Also check out CampbellChevrolet.com. Now to our conversation with Davenport, who just wrapped up his 16th season as Bellarmine head coach. Coach, first of all, thanks for being here.
Oh, thank you, guys.
Well, let's just dive right in. I mean, first of all, I remember you on the sidelines. I covered a lot of GLBC games back in the day, and I remember all those battles at the Pac Arena between USI and Bellarmine. So, I mean, this is going to be a lot of fun to talk with you today. Let's go back a little bit, though. What do you remember most about those early days, cutting your teeth as a grad assistant under Denny Crum for a year and going to BCU? What brought you back to Louisville to become the boys coach at Ballard, which would lead to a decade as coach of the Bruins?
Let's back up one little step. My first job ever, my first coaching job ever, other than basketball camps, I was the JV coach at a school that in 1980 closed. I was the JV coach for 2 years. And it was Aaron's High School in downtown Louisville. And I will forever be grateful of those 2 years because it really educated me to what coaching was about. And that is putting the players first for this reason. Aaron's High School was the most segregated school you could ever be a part of, and not based on race. It was segregated based on economics. Everybody in that school, regardless of their race, were not really well off. But the heart, the passion, and their desire to have people care about them, I think, created the foundation of why I wanted to be a basketball coach. It was ironic. Our principal would get a coupon to Frisch's for a big boy, a fry, and a shake. And you would think you're taking them to the greatest steakhouse in the world because they were so appreciative. We had one parent, Chris Middleton's dad, come to games. If you had a senior, at the time I was dating my wife, we got married right when I left there, and she would be a stand-in for senior night. It was so great to coach young people who wanted somebody to care about them and were passionate. You know, I was the JV coach at Ballard, which was the other end of the spectrum, you know, in the city of Louisville. That was incredible because it showed you how much you appreciate the opportunity to coach young people. Then you mentioned I left to go be a graduate assistant at U of L. And, you know, I'd been a walk-on JV player at Louisville. I'd worked camps ever since I was a student. So that was kind of a natural position, working for a soon-to-be Hall of Fame coach. And I immediately, at the end of getting my master's degree in college student affairs, I go to VCU, and I'm on a staff with Mike Polio as the head coach, who had left Kentucky Wesleyan to go to, he'd actually been assistant at VCU, back to VCU. And our staff consists of Tubby Smith, myself, a gentleman named Ed Webb, whose dad was an iconic coach at Old Dominion University, Paul Webb, and a GA named Ray Harper. That was our staff. You know, then back to Ballard to be a head coach, then to U of L and on and on and on. But I always say, and I say this sincerely, I would put my path as being the luckiest coach who's ever coached against anybody, any level, any sport, period.
I know we're going to get into Coach Crum a lot here throughout this podcast, but if you could elaborate,
How would you describe working with Denny Crum? And to that end, what he's like off the court? Because I had a few times where I had conversations with him when he was very giving of his time and efforts in terms of helping out with charity golf tournaments when I was working in Bowling Green, Kentucky. This gentleman is just so sincere, such a class act, and so accomplished on the basketball court as well. How would you sum it up?
Well, first of all, to put a little irony in it, when I was hired, he'd probably still be coaching today at 84 years old if he'd have got a shooter out of Bowling Green named Josh Carrier. I'll guarantee you Coach Crum was the number one fan in the Josh Carrier fan club. And I had Josh Carrier in basketball camp. That was my first time. So, and I go back to Daryl Carrier because I was the number one Colonels fan in the city of Louisville. So we're really showing some age and years now.
That's right.
Now, I'll tell you, Coach Crum, first and foremost, a tremendous person, a phenomenal person, impeccable. Secondly, great, great teacher. And he taught, as we go forward, I'll contrast it with Coach Pitino, but he taught in a very analytical way. But when you look at his background, he was a math major. So it would tend to be analytical. You know, he wanted you not just shoot the backboard, use the backboard. He wanted because it was at a 45-degree angle. But, you know, and being a great person and being, he was incredibly, incredibly patient. He was patient with players, with student managers, coaches. Now, don't take that the wrong way. Don't think he didn't compete. You want to compete. I don't care what it was in. He was going to win. It didn't make any difference. Charity golf event? Oh, he would provide items, but if he played in it, oh, he had to win it. Don't kid yourself. But I think just being a great person, incredibly patient, but being a teacher, I think he just embodied what it was to be a teacher of the game of basketball. That just happened to be a subject.
If you could compare the experience winning a KHSA state tournament title in 88 with a talented team that included Dwan Wheat and Allen Houston with your D2 national title team at Bellarmine in 2011.
I won't compare them in terms of picking a favorite, but I'll answer it like this. 3 years ago, this September, I did one of the greatest things I've ever done as a basketball coach. I invited the 1988 state championship team to my house on a Friday evening in September, 3 years ago this September. And 2 days before the event, Eric Gathright, who was our starting center, and all he did was rebound the ball, draw charges, and set screens to get people open, calls me, and we've got it all set. He calls me and says, Coach, he goes, I need a favor on behalf of the players. I said, what do you need? He said, Coach, he said, no girlfriends, no wives. I said, what? He said, Coach, we're 45 years old. She didn't go to Ballard. She'll want to leave at 9:30. We don't want to leave. We want to hang out. I said, well, you're going to make my wife and I look bad. We've got food planned. We got everything lined up. Coach, come on. You got to come through, Coach. No girlfriends, no wives. Now, I've got to be the bad guy and send out all the information to everybody. No girlfriends, no wives. You know, that's not a very popular position. But I gave in. I did what they asked. They left at 2:40 a.m. the next morning. It's one of the greatest things I've ever done as a basketball coach. They were 45 years old. Allen Houston's a vice president of the Knicks. Eric Gathright, 28 years at GE. Kenneth Martin, a middle school principal in Louisville. Todd Hired, a high school coach, former college coach in Indianapolis, on and on and on. But that night, they were teammates. I gave them each a DVD of the state tournament championship game with the voiceover from the play-by-play. And it was unbelievable. It was so great. And now you say, well, how's that compared to the 2011 national championship? The next July, we had the 2011 national champions over. Well, they were 28 years old. And they all brought their wives because they all met them at Bellarmine. And times change, my daughter-in-law and one of our player four Smallwood's wife, literally we fixed the TV up through the computer and we showed YouTube clips after clips, interviews, the game, highlights, highlight films, graduation, everything the whole night. But the greatest thing of both teams is what great teams do and what, as a society, what we need to do. They celebrated each other. It wasn't, oh, you were better than me, or you were the star, or you were an All-American. It was they celebrated each other. So to compare them is impossible. But to appreciate them and to learn from them and take from them will be with me to my last breath taken on this earth. And that will be incredibly, incredibly appreciative.
So, Coach, you know, the Carrier family got to know you and Coach Crum in the 90s. And, you know, my first, I guess, exposure to Louisville was my cousin Chris was a student manager there in the 90s. Yeah. And then the recruitment of Anthony Grundy there in the 90s as well. Got a little exposure to the program. I got to go to practice. I got to go to several games. I got the behind-the-scenes look. And as I grew into my basketball journey, I had the honor of receiving a scholarship offer from, you know, the Hall of Fame coach and Denny Crum. But it was really
cool.
That's
the only answer you went to basketball camp.
Well, hey, look, a lot of basketball camps, a lot of good times. But I will say I was a huge, huge Louisville fan, and I was a huge Denny Crum and Scott Davenport fan. I really was. And I tell people all the time, if I would have thought that Denny would have still been there, I would have probably gone to Louisville. But we just weren't hearing the right things that he was going to be there throughout my 4 years.
Right.
And I had, you know, other offers on the table that were very good as well. But I got to see you in practice, and I got to come to practice, and I thought it was really special because, number one, he's developing his co-head coach, his right-hand man. He's letting you run the practice. And number two, he's giving me his full attention during practice. And I just thought it was unbelievable for a guy of his track record to do that. But then going and coaching myself at Northern Kentucky and seeing that developmental piece of his assistant. And so that's where my question comes in. What were some of the things that you learned from him, or some of the things that you implement today that you learned under Coach Crum in that time of kind of being his right-hand man?
Josh, I love this question. First of all, put the players first. Second of all, there's a right way to play the game and a wrong way to play the game. That's the bottom line. You know, you can use the backboard or you can dunk it with two hands. There's a right way to play. You can play off 2 feet or you can play off 1 foot and charge. I mean, you can be in your stance and see the ball. The ball will tell you what to do. There's a right way to play the game and a wrong way to play the game. Now, that isn't in this demographic, that's not always popular. But if it leads to winning and winning is popular, then that'll help. You know, I kid our players all the time. Oh, that may not make a highlight film, but it may put a ring on your finger because it wins you championships. And Coach was a master of playing the game the right way. You know, we don't reinvent this game. Now, the other thing that Coach Crum was adamant about, and the first lesson in coaching, is there's more than one way to be successful. But that way, teaching the game the right way, the way I believe it should be played. Not that it's the only way, but it's worked for us. And I learned, obviously, from one of the absolute best. But being thorough, you know, when you work for someone like Coach Crum, every minute of every day, you want to please them. You want them to be proud of you because they teach such loyalty. And their value system is so predicated on putting everybody else first. The next time that Coach Crum brings attention to himself will be the first time, without a doubt.
So Coach, let me talk about this. I didn't get a chance to get to know this guy very well, but I've heard a lot of stories over the years. And so it was your next boss in Rick Pitino. Can you just talk about that transition, maybe the differences in styles and philosophies and some of the things that you learned from him?
I love the question. They both believe the game should be played the exact same way from a fundamental standpoint, they believe the exact same, but their approach to teach it is 180 degrees different, which tells you all you need to know about coaching. You know, Coach Pitino is going to coach like the building's on fire, 100 miles an hour, and never be sped up in a game, because when you speed up, you make mistakes. It's easier to throttle it back than it is to go to the whip and go to the accelerator in a game. So we're going to practice at the hardest, whereas Coach Crum was much more analytical, but they both thought the game should be played the same way instead of playing in balance, using that backboard or dunking it, being in your stance defensively, you know, having active hands. They both thought the exact same, but they taught it different. Now, when I say I'm the luckiest coach who's ever coached any game, any sport, any level, because I learned from two of the absolute best, but I had to be Scott Devon. I cannot be Coach Crum. I cannot be Coach Pitino. I had to be Scott Davenport. But to understand what it was like to coach under two individuals that were both, you know, slam dunk Hall of Famers, it just tells you how fortunate I am. But I've had so many coaches shape my life. And then, you know, I'll give you an example. Coach Pitino, I was the first coach he ever retained from a previous staff. So the 2 weeks between Coach Crum's retirement and Coach Pitino being hired were pretty challenging weeks. I've got two young sons, a wife, and I was incredibly, incredibly appreciative of Coach Crum giving me an opportunity from a graduate assistant on to being on the staff. So one morning, we're doing individual instruction at 7:30. And I had our players on the court at 7 o'clock, and Coach Pitino comes in and says, "Scotty, step into Coach's locker room. I need to speak with you." Well, everybody on this podcast understands what's coming. Thanks for everything. Good luck. See you, right? He calls me in there, and he says to me, "I'm never kept a coach from a previous staff." I respond to him, and I say, "Yes, sir, I'm aware of that." And he lost train of thought. He goes, "What?" I said, "Coach, I know you've never kept a coach on a previous staff. You coached at Kentucky. I coached at Louisville. I've read every book. I've listened to every speech. I know everything about you." And he started laughing. He said, "But I'm keeping you. I know you'll do a great job." So we went out among individual instruction, and then we got done, and we walked up three flights of stairs to the office. And to tell you how thorough he is, we got to the top of the steps. He turned to me. He's the most thorough man on earth. And he said, "I'm really thrilled that you're getting to stay." He said, "But I want to ask you a personal question." He said, "I know you lost your dad at a young age. Exactly how old were you? Were you 8? Were you 9? I know I'm close." And I said, "Coach, I was 9 years old, Halloween day, 15 feet from me, of a massive heart attack at 1:15 in the afternoon." He said, "That's right." He said, "Now, how old are your sons?" And I said, "They're 10 and 12. He said, "That's right, Russ and Doug." I said, "Yes, sir." He said, "I want you to go see Ray Ganong, our strength coach, and get yourself in shape, because your dad never saw you do one thing in your life. He didn't see you graduate from high school. He didn't see you graduate from college. He didn't see you get married. He didn't see you win a state championship at Ballard. He didn't see you get a job. He didn't see anything. And I want you to go get yourself in shape so you live healthy and you get to see Russ and Doug do great things. Your dad never got to see you do." 1 year to the day, after the day he told me that, I lost 73 pounds. He knew the button to push. And that very day, we went to recruit Antoine Barber, and we were driving to Wabash Junior College, and he turned to me. And he said, "You want to know why there was a lot of people didn't want me to keep you on the staff?" And I looked at him like, "I thought people liked me." He said, "You want to know why?" I said, "Yes, sir." He said, "Because they said you were so loyal to Coach Crum that I'd be making a mistake." And I looked at him and he said, you know what I told him? And I said, no, sir. He said, I told him he'll be that loyal to me. And that's why I'm keeping him. For the first time in my life, I'm keeping a coach from my previous staff. I'll never get a better compliment in my life than that.
To kind of follow up, you worked for Coach Crum, a Hall of Famer. Then you worked for Coach Pitino as a Hall of Famer. Then in 2005, you kind of got the itch to take the Bellarmine job. What got you there? Why?
Well, obviously, Coach Pitino, if you just look back, I think at the time I was the 23rd former assistant to become a head college coach. I think now the number's like 27. But what happened is Bellarmine stood for everything I stood for, academically, athletically, and socially. And I met with Scott Wiegandt. It was his end of his first year as the AD several times. We had a lot of a similar background. The president, Dr. Jay McGowan, wanted to win the right way with Bellarmine players. And it's ironic, and I can tell the story now. So we're on a run that's going to end up in the Final Four in St. Louis. Started in Nashville, then it went to Albuquerque, and then onto the Final Four in St. Louis. Coach Pitino, he was obsessed with it. I mean, every meal as a team, and we'd have in a meeting, he'd say, Scotty, you're going to get that job. I talked to this person, and I know this guy knows the president, and it was very important to him. And I would counter, Coach, let's worry about our team. Let's worry about the NCAA tournament. Coach, let's worry about – Coach, Scotty, you're going to get this job. Scotty, I talked to – I mean, it was unbelievable. So on a Wednesday night, the athletic director, Scott Wiegandt, calls me. He says, we're offering you the position. So I go in the next morning, and I walk into Coach Pitino, and I said, Coach, I need to speak with you. And I said, they called last night, and they offered me the job. And he spent 15 minutes yelling at me that I was making a mistake. Now I'm sitting there the most confused guy in the world because for 3 weeks, he has been obsessed with me getting this job, and now I'm like, what's he talking about? And I walked out, and Kevin Willard walks in my office. He said, Podsy, how confused are you right now? And I'm looking at him. He said, now he's realized how valuable you are. You'll never get a better compliment. He doesn't want you to leave. Well, I'd already taken the job. So Friday, I was introduced at a press conference on Friday morning. I was able to work our players out 2 days, Friday, Saturday, just through individual instruction. I ran the mini marathon here in Louisville with Kevin Willard that Saturday morning. So Saturday night finally hits. And there was two couples that our sons had gone to school together, and they were very loyal fans and family friends. And one got a promotion, another one had got a new position. So we all went to Pat's Steakhouse for dinner, and we went to our house for dessert. And now it's about 11:30. Coach Pitino calls me and says, Scotty, I want to thank you for the comments that you made when you were hired. And I said, well, Coach, they were the truth. Because I went out of my way to thank him. And he said, no, they were very appreciative. And then he started quizzing me. He said, what are you doing? Are you at a party? I said, no, Coach. I said, we have two couples over to have dessert because, you know, I got the job. And he goes, oh, wow, that's nice. Well, an hour later, the doorbell rings. Now, I got two sons that are teenagers, and the doorbell rings. That's not a great feeling at 12:30 in the morning. I race and answer it, and it's two bottles of Dom Perignon and a dozen flowers for my wife. He was on the West Coast. He had sent those. He had called a guy and had him go buy it and deliver it to the house and bought Sharon flowers and two bottles of Dom Perignon for my friends. And he said, thanks for everything. I still have both corks out of the bottles. I kept them. I'll keep them forever. So, you know, you work for people, and we win a national championship in 2011. The second voicemail in my phone is Coach Pitino. He was the last call that morning before we left the hotel. And you know, this year we make a transition to Division I. We play one of our first conference game in Freedom Hall, and who's sitting there? And right behind our bench, Coach Crum and Jerry May, our trainer, and one of our former student trainers. So, I mean, you know, coaching has found me through the greatest people you could ever encounter in any endeavor, any occupation. And I'm thankful every day.
Stay tuned for part two of our conversation with Bellarmine head coach Scotty Davenport. The Whistle Stop is sponsored by Jason Stonebreaker at Campbell Chevrolet on Scottsville Road in Bowling Green, Kentucky.
Out of curiosity, I think I remember you saying that you've never left Bellarmine because you've never had an agent. Now that you guys are D1 or in the process of moving to D1, would you ever see yourself leaving Bellarmine?
No. No. I've really, since a very, very young age, been a student of sports. You know, you never say never, you know, but
yeah.
I don't think there's a situation that would better serve my family, myself, and what I love to do, coaching. The bottom line is I get to go to work every day, not I have to go to work, and that's a big difference. Show me somebody that loves their job, and I'll show you somebody probably pretty good at it. Show me somebody that hates their job, I'll probably show you a miserable person. And, you know, if Coach K quits tomorrow and Duke calls, oh, we're going to listen. But you know what I'm saying. And I know this from day one, Bellarmine, it's been a marriage of what it should be to coach players from an academic standpoint, an athletic standpoint, and a social standpoint. You know, we've graduated 58 out of 61 players. We're at 31 straight semesters over a 3-0 as a team. And we've had 17 kids play pro. So we've covered it academically. We've covered it athletically. We've covered it socially. We've got two players right now. We've had 21 players play while in graduate school. Again, we've had 17 play professionally. Three still playing. I've always been a believer you can do both. And I would never want to be at an institution that didn't think the same way. You've got to do both. Josh knows. He was at the absolute highest of the level. And I just want our players to have four of the greatest years of their life while they're in college, but I wanted to prepare them for the next 45 years of their life. The passion, the discipline, the attention to detail, I hope it pays off for the next 45 years of their life.
When you look at your time there at Bellarmine, I mean, you inherited the program. They finished last in the league prior to when you got there. And by your fourth year, you get them to the D2 Sweet 16. It takes so much to get that done. And one of the things I remember when I watched your teams, I remember how you shared the basketball. I remember how quickly the ball moved a lot of times. It was just such unselfish play. It made me think, gosh, I wish I was a fly on the wall at practice to watch Coach Davenport's teams practice.
Well, first of all, you want to see that practice, come anytime. We invite people, and I understand there's restrictions with COVID and all that, but people are welcome to our practice anytime. I mean, high school coaches, youth school coaches, fans, media, they can come anytime. I love it. I absolutely. If they care enough about our program to come, they're welcome. But it started, think about it, you all in this podcast, you've answered kind of that, you kind of already answered that question. So I coach under two of the greatest pressing coaches in the history of college basketball. You know, Coach Pitino, I mean, Coach Crum brought it from Coach Wooden, who kind of revolutionized the ability to press. And Coach Crum was very effective in 2-2-1, and sometimes he denied and different things. Coach Pitino comes, and with the Unforgettables coaches at Kentucky, he's going to press, he's going to be up-tempo, and it goes on and on and on, winning a national championship at Kentucky to Louisville and on and on and on. All right. I get to Bellarmine. I'm not going to be able to press at that moment. Although, I thought maybe I could try because, you know, I'm such a great coach, I can get them to do it. No, it wasn't going to work. What evolved? You press from a technical standpoint. You press to speed your opponent up out of their comfort zone where they make a mistake. Yeah, a bad shot, a quick shot, a turnover, a steal, a charge, you're speeding them up. That's why you press. Well, why not press on offense? If I speed you up and you make a mistake, I've accomplished the same goal, except I'm doing it offensively, not defensively. How do you press on offense? Through incredible ball movement and player movement to get the defense to make a mistake. A long closeout, they turn their head in a back cut, they turn their head in a back screen. And you know what? In this day and age, pressing on offense and recruiting is a lot more attractive than it is pressing for Coach Pitino on defense, believe me. So we kind of evolved our philosophy of pressing on offense and then recruiting and taking off offensively, because it all goes back to recruiting. It helped. And 4 years ago, we had to get better defensively because the statistics didn't lie. Taking the ball out of bounds is hard to play at any level, but getting it off the backboard and being able to get a team in a scattered game. So we improved our defense, and I studied Dick Bennett, Tony Bennett, Bo Ryan. I had 92 pages of notes to kind of apply what we would be our strengths defensively, and we keep evolving. But I will say this. The last 10 years, we were Division II. For the 10 years, we led the nation in field goal percentage. Just flat field goal percentage, we led the nation 4 out of 10. 6 out of 10, we were in the top 4. In the United States, from shooting percent, you say, well, Coach, you got a bunch of Josh Terriers that can really shoot the ball. No. It was that passing that got the best shots. It was pressing on offense. Well, I sit here today, and we just completed our first year in Division One. Does anybody want to know where we are in field goal percentage this year? It's a pop quiz. I'm back in my teaching days now. I'm giving you a pop quiz.
Fourth, Coach.
Third. The third.
Oh.
You know who number one is? Gonzaga. Who was Gonzaga 20 years ago?
Bellarmine.
They were Bellarmine. Now, do we have players that work on shooting passionately? Yes. Do we work on it? Yes. But it's passing. I'm going to do a clinic in a couple weeks. They asked me to title my topic, and I said passing, the lost art. And it's not the three-quarter court, no look, you know, bounce pass to thread a needle. It's getting that guy the best shot. And I'll be honest, I love teaching it. And when you have players who love and want to learn it, you're going to have a heck of a practice. And that's going to equate to having a heck of a program.
So, Coach, I got a couple questions about recruiting. So, obviously, you're Division One now. And as we have seen, a couple of the other schools in the state might recruit really, really well, but we have seen that coaching plays a huge part in this thing. And I say that that is where Bellarmine has an advantage, is that coaching piece. But now that you're in Division One, does the recruiting philosophy change? I understand that most of your guys are within 3 or 4 hours of campus. Does that continue to be the norm, or do you reach out beyond that? And then the last thing is Freedom Hall. That is one of my favorite places to ever shoot a basketball. And how is that place helps in terms of getting kids to come play for you?
Well, first of all, I think the biggest another lost art in college coaching is the ability to judge talent. I really do. And I'm not being critical of other coaches. Like I've said over and over on this podcast, there's more than one way to be successful. But I learned from the Bill Olsons, the Jerry Joneses, the Coach Crums, the Rick Pitinos, that the ability to judge, you know, the Wade Houstons, the ability to judge talent and to see what really is going to fit in the way you're going to play. I'm asked when I give a corporate talk, and I'm asked all the time, Coach, how did Bellarmine in 05 win 9 games and 6 years after you came, you won a national championship? People ask me. And I think they think I'm going to say we ran this offense or we taught this. Or no, the greatest recruiters in this, the reason we've won and continue to win, you know, we transitioned into Division One, and we were picked 8th and 9th in the Atlantic Sun, and we finished 2nd. And we played for the championship. We played a one-game winner-take-all for the championship against a great Liberty team. But the greatest reason is the best recruiters in our programs are players. Show me a medical team with 5 great doctors. The 6th great doctors, he wants to join that team. or a law practice. You got five of the greatest attorneys. Well, that sixth attorney wants to join that team, or accounting, go on and on and on. The greatest recruiters in this program are our players. Now, we recruit endlessly. We evaluate. We judge talent. But then when you get the right guys who want to be there and they truly, truly are passionate about who they're playing with, the one thing that, and I know the game's undergone a lot of changes, it's never going to change. It's a team game. The five best players, very seldom, if ever, is going to be the best team. It's a team game. Always has and always will be. You bring up Freedom Hall. We were proud of the following we had here in Knights Hall. We were selling out on season tickets. Through COVID, we were going to be allowed to have 323 people. We couldn't use the lower seats. 323 now. From the health department meant officials, players, coaches, stat crew, radio, accounted everybody. The guy making the popcorn, selling the popcorn, taking the tickets, security. Well, we would have had the players' families and our families. That would have been it. And Dr. Mark Lynn, you know, who's been the greatest contributor to this program and believer and supporter of this program, because he's not just a supporter, he's a believer. In September, said, you should go to Freedom Hall. We should go to Freedom Hall. And the dream was born. And then in a quick 2 months, we're playing in Freedom Hall. Josh is right. It's a phenomenal shooting place, but it's a great place to watch basketball. We spent a month with our players educating them. Who's walked down that ramp? Muhammad Ali's first professional bout ever. Coach Wood won a national championship there. Oscar Robertson, four presidents of the United States, Rolling Stones, Elvis Presley, go on and on and on. That's not even counting Coach Crum, Coach Patino, Coach Rupp, Coach Hall, Tubby Smith. Go on and on and on. And this is where we're going to call home. And then when I was hired, I said to Dr. McGowan, it'll take everybody. And I'm gonna cite you two examples. So the last court that was ever played in Freedom Hall, when Louisville left, they sanded the court down, and for two more years, for two single games, Kentucky played in Freedom Hall. So it was totally a UK court, looked just like Rupp Arena. Well, we wanted it to be a Bellarmine court. Well, during the pandemic, one of the group that's prospered as much as anyone has been like Home Depot. Those people were forced to stay home, and they were home improvement, et cetera. And I did some research, and I walked into a Home Depot, and I just walked in to ask who I need to talk to, because they do floors. Let's see if they'll redo our floor and make it a Bellarmine floor. Well, come to find out, I found a gentleman who agreed, but he said, Coach, you need to go way above me. And I said, what? He said, oh, yeah, you need to go find the real lover of Bellarmine University. And I'm like, okay, I'm listening. He said, out of Atlanta is a gentleman named Tim Horrigan. He's a Bellarmine graduate. You could have knocked me over with a feather, because I'm like, you got to be kidding me. Tim Horrigan is 63 years old. He grew up in the west end of Louisville, moved to St. Matthews, went to Trinity, went to Bellarmine, got a degree in accounting, worked for Brown & Williamson, worked for Sears in Chicago, and now he's number two in the world at Home Depot. You know what my connection is? When I was coaching at Ballard, he was arguably the best official in Louisville and had every big game I had. And I probably yelled at him more than any official ever. I got in contact with him. My opening statement was, Ballard Eastern, you called a charge and it was a block all the way and I'm not backing up. And we started laughing, and our floor was totally redone by Home Depot. How about that for basketball? That's Tim Horrigan, a tremendous Bellarmine graduate who I wasn't even aware of the successes he had. And we're so proud of that, because it's about relationships. Our last game against Liberty, by the state-mandated orders, we were turning them away. There was people at the gate. They wasn't mad at Bellarmine. They were mad they hadn't gotten tickets earlier. So we can just go let it grow from here. But it is a great, great place to watch basketball.
Well, Coach, that's a perfect segue to my next question, because I just literally had asked Scotty D a referee question. And that's a perfect segue. It talks about how relationships go into everything in life, and including officiating. And you and I talked a little bit off air about a couple of your favorites. And whenever Jerry used to send you crews, it was the better crews, because they knew they had to deal with Scotty that night. And just talk about maybe a story that you've got an interaction with a referee. And I know you have a lot of respect for what referees do, especially the higher levels, because it's their job, and they have pride in it just like coaches do.
My respect for referees, and my biggest advice to referees, is the game is played, officiated, it's coached, and it's administered by human beings. Am I tough on them? Yes. Am I tough on myself? Yes. So it's fair. And if I know the rules, I expect them to know the rules. But it is a game, again, played, officiated, coached, administered by humans. Official looks at me and says, Coach, I blew it. There's nothing you can say. In my opinion, the best of the best are phenomenal communicators, because they understand it's played by humans and coached. Now, you want to argue? You probably picked the wrong guy in me, because I'll argue. But it happens, because it's the respect you have for them, and the best I've ever been around, the best of the best, they're great managers of people, because they're great communicators. The players, coaches, the table, because it takes everybody. Do I think the replays are being overused? Well, I'm torn, because I want it right, but the flow of the game is being destroyed at 1:59 on the clock, but at 2:01 on the clock, nothing happens. So there's got to be a happy medium here somewhere. But the best of the best are great communicators, because they're great people, no doubt.
Talk about kind of how unique it is that you get to work with your son day in and day out.
Well, I'll say this. I'm much more proud of Doug as a son than I will ever be as a coach. And the same for Russ. We have been blessed with two incredible sons. And it's not easy. The son of a coach, and what my wife had to go through. We adopted, we rescued a Cocker Spaniel from the streets of Lexington one year. I was there for the state tournament. And his name was Critter. And they used to laugh that if things went bad when I was coaching, they would get home, get him in bed, lights out, before I'd get home, because they know how bad it was. But, Critter would meet me. If I gave him a treat, it was unconditional love. Well, that's what my family has done, because it's difficult. It's difficult on time, the things you miss, the sacrifices that you make to coach other people's sons that you're missing your own. Their games, their accomplishments, et cetera. And sometimes you get home, they're already in bed, but we've been incredible lucky. But I can tell you this about my staff. Coach Pitino's first staff at Louisville was Mick Cronin, Kevin Willard, myself. We'd get there about 6 every morning. Think of those sitting in my office waiting for Coach Pitino to tell us, let's go, we're ready to go, let's meet. And it's Kevin Willard, Mick Cronin, and myself. Pretty good meetings every morning. Now, to have Doug and Bo Braden, Scooter Galloway, and Al Davis, this staff is incredible. And you're never successful without it. Lots made about, at this time of year, about being a coach of the year. It should never, ever be coach of the year. It should be staff of the year, period. That's it. That's how I feel. I'll never change from that.
Good luck to you. Thanks so much.
Go get them, Coach. Good luck, man. We appreciate everything.
Anything I can ever do, you guys, let me know.
Thanks, yes, Coach.
Thanks, here. Coach.
Take care, guys.
You've been listening to The Whistle Stop, sponsored by Jason Stonebreaker at Campbell Chevrolet on Scottsville Road in Bowling Green, Kentucky. Call or text Jason at 270-996-8365 to schedule your spring or summer test drive. And check out the hashtags Buy From Stoney, Stoney Sells, and BG Cars for the latest new and used car information. Find The Whistle Stop wherever you get your podcast, and follow us on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram @WhistleStopPod.